Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming out tonight. I don't want to talk about Kafka, but I want to start with Kafka. As you may know, there was an 8-year-long, highly contested court case that went to the Israeli Supreme Court that determined that the lost manuscripts of Kafka belong not in Germany, not in private hands, but to the National Library in Jerusalem. As I sat in the Israeli Supreme Court in Jerusalem hearing the proceedings of this case, I realized that the Israeli side was making an extremely interesting assumption about the diaspora and Israel. The assumption was very simple. It was that a man like Kafka, who both in biography and in the style of his writing is as diasporic as they come, is as a paradigm of diaspora writing as they come, who never stepped foot in Israel, who died before there was a state, somehow, because of the gravitational pull that Jerusalem represents, he should properly belong in Jerusalem. And I realized that Jerusalem exerts a certain cultural gravitational force. What I'd like to do with you this evening is to take you with me on a journey to Jerusalem to experience that gravitational force. And the means of doing so is to look at Jerusalem not in the usual way as a chronological series of conquests or as a series of archaeological layers, but to look at it in a bit of an unusual way, which is through its texts and libraries and archives as a series of textual layers. For the last several years, I've been working with two colleagues in Jerusalem. One is a historian named Merav Mack, and the other is a photographer named Frederik Brenner. And the three of us have been collaborating on a book that we've just now, in these very moments, finishing. It will come out in May with Yale University Press with full-color photographs. It's called Jerusalem City of the Book. To accompany us on our short journey through Jerusalem this evening, I'm going to be using some of Frederik Brenner's photographs. These are the first time that they're being shown outside of Jerusalem itself. What we learned in our journey through some of the most inaccessible places in Jerusalem, and I'll explain why they're inaccessible in a moment, we learned that Jerusalem is not just any city, but in effect, it's a dual city. In Hebrew, it's Yerushalayim shel mala v'Yerushalayim shel mata, which is to say that there is a celestial Jerusalem and there's an all-too-earthly Jerusalem. There's an imagined Jerusalem and there's a mundane Jerusalem. So what we're going to do together today is look at how Jerusalem has been imagined and how it's been made legible, that is, how it's been made readable, and how the two Jerusalems are connected. That is, how is the mundane Jerusalem tethered to the imagined Jerusalem? In that spirit, Frederik Brenner's photographs act in a way as statements in their own right. What we're looking at now is his photograph of the Armenian Manuscript Library in Jerusalem in the Old City, which captures something of the mysterious sacredness of the place, as if this is not just a library, but a temple of reverence for the volumes that it contains. Now, it's very difficult to get into some of these libraries. They're not exactly accessible to the public. It took us months, if not years, of negotiations to get in. But one of the tricks that we used is we used precisely the rivalries of Jerusalem to get access. So, for example, we told the Greeks, this is Frederik's photograph of the Greek manuscript library, we told them that the Armenians had already given their great rivals, had already given us access, and if you don't give us access, then it would be a shame because the Armenians are going to be in our book, and why not you? The lovers of Jerusalem's literary legacy are also the gatekeepers who keep out other people from that legacy. These two men bending over the page of a 1,000-year-old manuscript are on the right the patriarch Theophilus, and on the left the archbishop, who's also the librarian, Aristarchos. At first, both men denied when we finally got an audience with the patriarch, both men denied our request to access this very room. And the reason that they gave us for denying us access was a single word, Uspensky. And so we had to look into who this Uspensky fellow was. It turns out that he was an Orientalist, a great scholar of manuscripts, and as it happens, a thief from here. In the 19th century, this Bishop Uspensky walked away from this very room, from the Greek Orthodox manuscript library, with some of the most precious texts in Greek, including some of the earliest New Testaments, and he brought them back to Moscow, where they are still to this day in the Moscow State Library, formerly the Lenin Library, I think it's called. So first of all, it's a lesson in the long institutional memories of Jerusalem. And secondly, it's a lesson in, I think, because this is finally, we obviously did get in, they showed us a 1,000-year-old palimpsest, which, as you know, is a later text which is written over an earlier text, in some cases saving the earlier text from obscurity, rescuing it by reusing it, unintentionally rescuing it. So as we stood, the three of us in the room with Aristarchos and Theophilus, we wondered to ourselves, can we read Jerusalem itself, in effect any city, but especially Jerusalem itself, as a palimpsest of layers in which one layer, whether it be Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, and we're going to be introduced to libraries of each type, in which the newer layers of text doesn't so much eradicate a memory as much as it appropriates and recycles early memory. Can we understand Jerusalem itself as a kind of palimpsest that has a conversation between languages in which texts and voices reach out for each other across the centuries? After we got to access to the Greeks, of course, also the Armenians agreed, and this is the oldest illuminated manuscript in Jerusalem. It's never before been photographed. It's a gospel on parchment that dates to the 8th century. This is a symbol of how each of Jerusalem's communities, as I say, Christian, Islamic, and Jewish, use text to root themselves, to anchor themselves in the city. That is to say that the rivalries of Jerusalem are not just about territory, they're also about continuity. How old does my continuity go, and is my continuity older than yours? For that very reason, some of the Armenian manuscripts are so precious that they're not kept in the room that we saw earlier in the first photograph. They're kept in the treasury. To learn about the manuscripts in the treasury, which are more sort of valued as objects than as anything anybody would actually read, we got an audience with this man, who is the Patriarch Manoogian, who was elected in 2013 as the 97th Armenian Patriarch of Jerusalem. And Patriarch Manoogian told us that the treasury is not accessible to any one person. There are three keys owned by three different people, one of whom being the patriarch himself. All three need to be present at the same time to open the treasury. And I was thinking it was like the nuclear codes or something. Example number one was the Armenians. Example number two is the Syriac-speaking community of Jerusalem, also in the Old City. Unlike the Armenians, the Syriacs, who speak a form of Aramaic that goes all the way back to Jesus, don't have a quarter of their own. They're a more poor and less influential community. This man who we were privileged to spend many hours with is named Abuna Shimon. He's the keeper of the manuscripts, of the Syriac manuscripts of Jerusalem. He happened to mention that he venerates some of the manuscripts in his care to such a degree that he actually kneels when he reads them. And this library points to one of the surprising, if mundane, reasons for the secrecy that enshrouds so many of Jerusalem's libraries, and that is very simple: shame and embarrassment. About 2.5 years ago, there was an exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum in New York about medieval Jerusalem. The curators of that exhibition came from New York to Jerusalem to collect objects and manuscripts, and they asked for our help in introducing them to Abuna Shimon. And he simply apologized because he was embarrassed